Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sarah Vowell, whose newest book is Assassination Vacation, came out a year ago in hardback, now out in trade paperback. Sarah Vowell is also a voice on The Incredibles. You're Violet, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
And writes for The New York Times now, NPR commentator. Sarah Vowell, let's talk about Assassination Vacation. Was it seeing Sondheim's assassins that prompted you to begin your tour of assassination sites?
No, it wasn't. I don't know what it was. I'm a writer who writes books, and I couldn't think of a book idea, and then one day I did. So I basically had the idea and then started pursuing it. It's not a very dramatic story. But then I think maybe later on, after I had seen a production of Assassins in the Berkshires, a really great summer stock production, and I read there was a little note from the director talking about violence and violence towards presidents specifically, and it was right when we had gone to war. It was just this really meandering piece of writing where the director was, you know, saying how I kind of can sort of understand how these crazy guys could want to do harm to a president. Not that I condone that, you know, it was just one of those kind of things.
Right.
But it sort of was a little light bulb that maybe I was reading about people who had done harm to presidents was a kind of, maybe in a sort of Psych 101 kind of way, sort of about my own, you know, resentment toward the current president. But I also, like that director will say, I'm opposed to murder in general and assassination in particular.
You cover three presidents who got assassinated in this book. When you take them one by one, there are certain similarities to all of them and certain things that keep recurring. And one of the things that keep recurring is the presence of Robert Todd Lincoln, son of Abraham Lincoln. How did you find out that he was affiliated with all three assassinations in a weird way?
How did I figure it out? I figured it out because he was in the train station with James A. Garfield, because he was Garfield's Secretary of War. And then, you know, knowing about the Lincoln assassination, and he wasn't at the theater, but he was there at his father's deathbed. And then, because of that, I read a really boring biography of him and found out the third that he was, you know, getting off the train in Buffalo as McKinley was being shot. And so he was kind of haunted by all of that. I mean, I call him Jinxie McDeath because, you know, every time he shows up, someone's going to die. But because he was Abraham Lincoln's son, he was, you know, being invited to various White House events over the years, and he lived a really long time. He always said, if only they knew, they wouldn't want me there.
He was also not a very nice person.
No, I'm not a big fan of his. And part of the reason I did those three and not Kennedy is you can kind of watch the party of Lincoln turn into the Republican Party. I'm sure everyone listening to Pacifica Radio knows and loves. And Robert Todd Lincoln exemplifies, you know, what the Republican Party became, you know, these, like, old rich guys.
The descent from Abraham to Robert Todd is the descent of the party of the Emancipation Proclamation into the party of Bush and Cheney.
Yeah, well, and especially not so much with Robert Todd Lincoln, but by ending with McKinley. I mean, he's the last Civil War veteran president and takes us into the Spanish-American War, which is the first war that North and South fight together as a united country. And he and his Karl Rove, Mark Hanna, figure out, I mean, it's amazing that they figured out, hey, let's get white male Southerners to join the Republican Party. I mean, it's hard. You can't imagine the Republican Party without white male Southerners. That's the core of the Republican Party. But Hanna and McKinley decide that they're going to woo these guys. And one way to do it is McKinley, especially because of after the Spanish-American War, gives these speeches in the South saying, you know, now the Civil War is just about American valor. That's what it's about. That's what he says. So as a way of, you know, getting all these ex-Confederates to give him money and support, and it, you know, worked. Boy, did it work.
The other thing about McKinley is that he made the United States an international power through the Spanish-American War, which was an optional war. You also say that the Wolfowitz of the McKinley administration was his successor, Theodore Roosevelt.
I love Theodore Roosevelt. I have certain qualms about him, especially this bloodthirsty side of his. But he just wanted to live. And to him, if you were a man, to really have lived, you had to have fought in a war. And so he's actually, you know, has a real position of responsibility in the American military. He's Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He resigns his very important military job and, like, has this volunteer, you know, this volunteer troop, you know, the Rough Riders, of course. So he just becomes this volunteer guy so that he can wear the uniform that he, you know, goes to Brooks Brothers and picks out his outfit. And he's just so excited. And just like his memoir of that time is, he's just so enthusiastic about it. And the only little, I don't know if I even mentioned this in the book, but the only little kind of nag of conscience that he has is, when they were training in Texas and they have to take a train across the South to get to Cuba, and all the old Confederate war widows, all the women are waving at the train at the soldiers, and they're the young girls who are, you know, excited to see the young soldiers, and then he sees the old war widows, the old Confederate war widows looking at him like, you know, they have a little less rah 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 version of war, I guess. But yeah, he was just so bully for that war.
That comparison between the Vietnam veterans watching the Iraq people go off to war is really strong.
Yeah.
You know, which brings me to a question that I was going to ask later on, but I'm going to throw it out now, which is that when you do this kind of research and you walk away, you know, yeah, you're going to write a book about the specifics, but, I mean, do you get some kind of overarching idea about America that you don't have before when you do this kind of research? Does it say anything to you?
Well, it doesn't necessarily say anything I want to know, you know.
Right.
But that Cuba situation, we say we're going in there to liberate Cuba, and it's, 108 years later, and Cuba still isn't free. I mean, it does give me serious qualms about, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom, I guess, and I mean, yeah, I have doubts about this country's track record with stuff like that.
And this just reinforces it, then.
Yeah.
The other thing is, in talking about the Garfield story, I mean, one thing I love about the book, aside from it being very funny, Sarah Vowell, is that you take these little asides, these little side trips, which apparently you let your mind wander, you let yourself go where you needed to go. And in the story of Garfield, we wander into the story of infighting between Rutherford B. Hayes and Roscoe Conkling, and how Hayes was put into office in ways not dissimilar with Bush,
mm-hmm.
and that Garfield's vice president, who became president, Chester Alan Arthur, was put in power by Conkling, who was trying to control basically graft out of the Customs House.
Yeah, well, the New York Customs House was, that's where the majority of the federal government's income came from before the income tax. And so the Customs Inspector of New York, which Chester Arthur had been the Customs Inspector of New York, was the, like, most cherished plum job in the federal government, like, way more than president even, because those guys were taking, they were just, the customs inspectors were taking home just, you know, millions of dollars in cash just in their pockets. And so whoever controlled that job, which Conkling, the Republican boss of New York, if you had the customs inspector in your pocket, I mean, you win, because, you know, you just have all that money behind you. There is something sort of reassuring about that, finding stuff like that out, I find, because one thing I just loathe is this idea of the good old days and how, you know, we used to be this moral, upright country, and now everything is just, you know, infighting and violence, and we were always a violent country, and we were always money-grubbing and, you know, greedy and corrupt. And I find it just kind of reassuring to know that, actually, you know.
In reading your book and then looking in the daily papers about Abramoff, how can you say Abramoff is the most corrupt thing to happen when you've got the Customs House story, which involved 15 years or so of American politics.
Yeah. Well, you can go back farther than that. You can go back to the Old Testament. Like, one thing I love about all the Ten Commandments hoopla is, we should post the Ten Commandments to remind people to be moral the way they used to be. Well, the whole reason we have the Ten Commandments is, you know, like, the Israelites are free for, like, 10 minutes, and they start melting their earrings to worship some, you know, cow god. Like, we, you know, like, that's just how humans are. There's no golden era behavior-wise.
Sarah Vowell, in talking about this book and in looking at these three presidents and what happened, we also get into other areas, one of which is something called the Oneida community. I had never heard of it. This was Charles Guiteau, the assassin of Garfield, was involved with them.
That was actually my favorite part of the book to work on. It was like, I think I learned about them for maybe 2 minutes in high school American history when you do the utopian communities. Maybe you talk about Brook Farm or something and then move on. But we certainly never talked about what was actually going on there. It's a really fascinating place. I mean, it's this biblical sex cult, basically. It started in 1848, and it's a cult. So there's the cult leader, this guy John Humphrey Noyes. He has the epiphany that the New Jerusalem happened in the year 70 AD, so that we're all living in heaven on earth, and so we're already perfect in the eyes of God. And I forget the exact reasoning how he gets from there to that there should not be marriage, but they have what they call group marriage. And it's actually where the term free love comes from, was for this community. And it's this house in upstate, this mansion in upstate New York. I mean, it was a really interesting place. It was pretty egalitarian. I mean, the cult leader, obviously, is the leader, but it was, you know, there's free love was not particularly free because there are just all these rules. And one of them to prevent unwanted pregnancy was that the men were not to ejaculate. So that was one thing. So there are a lot of kooky things like that. I went there, and one thing you can learn through historical tourism that you can't maybe necessarily get out of books is when you go to these places, a lot of the times the guides, the docents, the park rangers, it's sort of like talking, you can learn a lot by talking to someone's mother, you know, and they treat their subjects with such empathy. And so I had this great tour guide at Oneida, this retired history teacher. I mean, it's easy to laugh off the Oneida Experiment as this kooky commune cult, and it, not that it wasn't, but he was saying how, like, because he's a volunteer there, he just spent all this time thinking, like, why would they do this? I mean, they went there in the middle of the 19th century to lead these really eccentric lives. And then he was thinking about Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and Puritanism and that strain of Christianity. And then he said, maybe coming here in that time under those circumstances was, like, he says, this shot of oxygen. And if you think about it, like, especially for women, to have this place to go where, you know, you didn't have to be someone's wife if you didn't want to be, you didn't have to be someone's mother, you could just be part of this group and help make the decisions and raise the food and sleep with whomever you wanted within reason. It must have been nice even to know that it was there.
I thought it was also very funny when you mentioned that the problem with Charles Guiteau is that he went there and he couldn't get any. 5 years
he spent
in a free love commune.
To be the one guy at the free love commune who could not get laid, that was his lot in life. I mean, he is probably the funniest of the assassins to talk about because, I mean, he's humor gold because he's so self-absorbed, which is, you know, the classic, there's no better comedic character than someone who is so incompetent and yet so self-confident, you know, and so, yeah.
And his trial was kind of like the laugh riot of the year.
Yeah, because he just thought he should be president, and he thought everyone would thank him for shooting the president. And he wrote this long autobiography, and he'd petitioned the judge to read his autobiography to the crowd, and he keeps interrupting his own attorneys, and he was funny.
You're listening to an interview with Sarah Vowell, whose latest book is Assassination Vacation. Sarah Vowell, let's talk about some other issues here. How did you get involved with writing columns for the New York Times?
I did a stint last summer because the op-ed page editor, Gail Collins, read my book and liked it.
And that's when you wrote the piece on, I think it was the Minutemen.
Yeah, right. The Minutemen who are patrolling the border versus the old punk band, the Minutemen. I was more in favor of the old punk band.
They also post the letters about it.
Uh-huh.
What do you do when you see them? What do you think of those? Do you want to respond? Or
do I want to? No. I feel like that's for the readers. I'm actually very much in favor of things like letters to the editor. I don't know how I feel. No, I do know how I feel about, you know, direct response to a writer. I find that not very civic-minded and also clogs up one's email inbox. But I'm all for responses being posted, sure.
So do you read them?
Sometimes. I find the problem with something like some behemoth like the New York Times is, and the one reason I don't actually totally enjoy doing it is because it's all about the New York Times. And so many of the letters aren't really about what I have to say. They're about, like, comparing me favorably or for ill to other columnists, or if it's conservatives ranting against the liberal New York Times. Or I wrote one column last summer. It was right when the one campaign ad that had Pat Robertson in it, and I said that I was applauding him for joining that campaign. And I enumerated all his, you know, numerous, you know, things he said and done that I'm not very happy with. But I just say this one problem is so huge, even the questionable weirdos of the world are like, let's try and solve this, you know. And, man, I just got slammed by all by liberals who were just offended that I would say one nice word about Pat Robertson, you know. Just like that kind of stuff, I don't know. It was interesting. I don't care one way. I actually don't really care whether people like my writing or not. But it was so interesting, all that feedback. But so much of it is not about what you're actually writing. It's about the person's relationship to the paper or other writers at the paper or, you know, some larger agenda. So I don't know. It's interesting, but I think it would get kind of annoying if that was my only job.
And your work with The Incredibles doing a voiceover. Mm-hmm. Somebody contacted, from Pixar, contacted you?
Yeah, they heard my documentaries on This American Life and thought I could be a superhero.
How was it? You were by yourself when you did those. You weren't interacting with other actors.
Right? I was interacting with Brad Bird, the director, is quite an actor. He was also the voice of Edna Mode. He would do all the other parts, and he's a wonderful performer. It was always just him and me.
How long did it take you to do that?
It took a long time. I think the sessions went almost 3 years.
And you also worked on the video game, too.
Mm-hmm. That was actually fun. I remember doing some recordings for those, like the video games, while I was working on that book. And when I was writing the thing about the 1880 Republican Convention, where Garfield gets the nomination, I was writing about that in the morning, and then the afternoon recording for the Incredibles video games and saying things like, the robot lost its claw! And it was a nice little contrast, I guess. Or last summer when I was writing those guest columns for the New York Times, I was also recording for Disney on Ice, you know. So I like to dabble, I guess.
Do they pay well to do The Incredibles?
They pay scale, but then, you know, once the residuals kick in, those are quite exciting.
When you finally saw The Incredibles, how was your feeling seeing that your voice line up to this other character?
Well, the first time I saw it all, I was just checking, because I had never acted before, I was just checking to see if I stood out as horrible. And just, like, not even was I good, was I normal? Did it seem like it was part of the movie? But, I mean, it's such a great story, and also the music really got me the first time through, that I kind of, you know, calmed down and wasn't really about me. I could tell the first time I saw it, like, this will be one of those classic films, you know, that generations of children will enjoy. And that was pretty exciting.
Recently, there's been scandals in the publishing industry, the story of J.T. Leroy,
mm-hmm.
and also the story of James Frey making up pieces of about 500,000 pieces of The Million Little Pieces.
Uh-huh.
When you see this and you write nonfiction, does that ever bother you at all? I mean, most of this is historical,
mm-hmm.
but it also involves your traveling with friends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any point where you might have lied or exaggerated, but you could have lied and exaggerated and gotten away with it.
I guess I could have. Yeah, I mean, I take the nonfiction label fairly seriously, but something like claiming a persona, I don't know how I feel about that morally. It doesn't really bother, I guess because I come from a rock and roll background, you know?
Right.
So, like, I can't remember what Richard Hell's real name is, nor do I really care. So stuff like that then just seems kind of overly theatrical, but I don't really have a problem with it. The thing I love about being a writer is, and the only thing I ever wanted, even when I was a little kid, like, all I ever wanted was a job. I like writing as a job and a craft, and I'm really proud of how hard it is, and it just takes just sitting there, and it's just so very, very unglamorous and undramatic, actually writing a book. So in some ways, the journeyman writer in me is, you know, takes offense at all of these theatrics, because I think, you know, writing a book is really enough. You don't have to pretend to be someone else or, you know, but in terms of other people's exaggerations, it doesn't bother me when David Sedaris does it. I think it only bothers me if, say, you make someone's medical ethics seem borderline illegal. That would be, I have problems with that.
With the J.T. Leroy story, the books have to stand for themselves.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
I mean, they
so,
are fiction.
Yeah, and so it doesn't really matter who wrote them, really, or what the story is. I guess the only, to me, I read the story about that the other day, the only sad part is how much the deception takes a toll on, you know, everyone involved.
Erica Chong made a point in a recent article about the relationship of truth and what we hear from the Bush administration. And how truth has become this subjective entity. What we're seeing in both stories is how suddenly it's not truth. There's one side and the other side, and truth seems to disappear.
While you were saying that, I'm sorry, I have that old Johnny Cash song stuck in my head, you know, what is truth? I don't know what to say about that other than to say I try to tell the truth in my books, but, I mean, the edited truth, I find the first person is a really great place to hide, for example, and I only tell you what I want you to know, and things aren't true, but it's not the whole truth. It's actually what I love about writing, in fact, and as opposed to talking. You know, as you can see, I'm kind of a little bit of a flibbertigibbet talker, and I trail off, or I don't know what to say, or I say like too much, or whatever it is. But I love writing books, especially because there's just that time to decide, you know, what do I want to say? How do I want to say it? And just, you know, work on it. And it's kind of, in a way, to me, sort of utopian.
When you're working on a piece for NPR, mm-hmm. or when you're working on a piece for The Times versus this, do you do a lot more editing and a lot more rewriting in the books?
There's no more editing or rewriting in any form of journalism on the planet than that goes on at This American Life. It is the most rigorously edited thing on Earth, I think. I mean, so it's just edited within, I mean, the great thing is it's edited within every single breath, you know, but it sounds so spontaneous. But some of those stories there are just like, you know, 90 drafts of them. But some of my qualms about writing for a daily have to do with time. You know, I've gotten really slow and careful, and I do want to get things right. And when you're working so fast, and there just isn't always time to do that. But with the books, my favorite thing is like after the first draft, then it's all, you know, editing and reworking and honing and cutting things out and putting things in and just making it better. That's the joy of writing to me. And actually that comes from working on This American Life. I think when I was younger, I was a much more Beat Generation type, spontaneous, you know, jazz kind of girl. But now I just love going through the drafts and nitpicking.
Putting in jokes, taking them out.
Yeah.
Do you have readers who check to see whether stuff is funny or?
No. Some of the more humorous bits of that assassination book, I do a lot of readings in New York with the downtown-y stand-ups, and because I'm friends with them, I just stand there and read. I don't do stand-up, but I will do some of their shows, and some of those pieces I did I did read in front of audiences in little comedy kind of clubs on the Lower East Side, and that was just to check to see how things were coming off to people.
One of the funniest parts of the book is how you drag along your three-year-old nephew on all of these trips, mm-hmm. and he seemed to like it a lot more than his mother.
Yeah, well, he's super morbid. I mean, it was so great when he started talking because he is so morbid. And also the places I would take him just seemed like places out of his favorite show, Scooby-Doo. You know, I remember being at the cemetery in Cleveland where the Garfield tomb is and him talking about the crypt. And I was just so proud, you know, that he only knew, he knew fewer than 100 words and one of them is crypt.
Do you think that as a columnist and commentator, you have some kind of political obligation?
I do have a little bit of a civics, yeah. I mean, that's actually why I do it, because I don't actually like it. Like last summer when I was trying to decide whether to do that Times thing, I thought, well, this is my one chance to make Karl Rove feel bad, you know? I mean, I like papers and I like free speech, and I will occasionally dabble in that stuff. I don't want to do that for a living. It's incredibly seductive, though, because like you could see like people talking about it or having influence or whatever. I could see how that could be seductive, but I'm more selfish than civic minded, and all I really want to do is write what I want to write.
Sarah Vowell, before we went on the air, you said you hadn't begun working on another book. If you do begin working, when you do, would it be similar to the last two in terms of touring around?
No, I don't think so. I think it'll probably be historical, but maybe it might have a little more to do with the written word, the written record of our ancestors.
Have you ever thought about writing fiction?
Nope. I'm not one of those writers who's always wanted to be a writer. I actually got into writing by being an art history major and writing term papers and blue book essay exams. So that's how I came. I came out of criticism, and this is pretty much me, like this narrative stuff is me working at pretty much the most entertaining I can be. But also, I just love nonfiction because of how unbelievable it is. You know, like I love coincidences and eerie, freaky things, and I think fiction has to be sort of plausible. I make a lot of hay with Robert Todd Lincoln in the book because there are all these eerie things that happen, you know, like he saved from a train platform by John Wilkes Booth's brother Edwin, or Edwin, you know, picking up these plaster casts of hands at a party and asking who they are, and, oh, those are the hands of Lincoln, you know, the man your brother murdered, or Robert Todd Lincoln being in all three, around all three assassinations, you know, that kind of thing. If that were in a novel, it would just be so ridiculous. Like, no one would believe that. But nonfiction is just full of all these kind of little magical, miracle-seeming things that probably don't mean anything, but they feel like they do, and it's really pleasurable. So, yeah, I'm a nonfiction person.
When that happens, it's sort of like one of those little epiphanies. Aha!
Yeah.
I got another one.
Yeah, I mean, it's so great to just be reading some really, really boring old book or going through papers or whatever and have one of those no way kind of moments, you know?
You've been listening to an interview with Sarah Vowell, whose latest book, Assassination Vacation, is just out in trade paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.